Who Cares Wins? Phrase or meaningful question. A podcast for the deep thinker, the curious intellect, and for those who care deeply about the planet. Also, sometimes referred to as Who Cares Who Wins.
Hello and welcome to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. I'm deeply in love with and also very concerned for our planet. And in this podcast series, I want to unearth different climate solutions that we can get on board with, including looking at contradictions and divergent opinions. And in case you're not a walking Wikipedia, we'll be hearing more from our lovely producer, Kelsey, who'll be springing in from time to time to help clarify any moments or statistics for you. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, Lily.
So far in this season, we've looked at the different ways in which improving women's equality will positively impact on climate solutions. And today we're going to look at the connections from a different perspective, asking who is being most impacted by climate change. I speak with Chelsea Clinton, global public health advocate and vice chair of the Clinton Foundation, which was set up by her parents, Bill and Hillary Clinton. Chelsea teaches at Columbia University, has authored several children's books, and broadcasts via her podcast, In Fact. We recorded this interview last year after Chelsea supported the She Changes Climate movement, which sought to bring gender parity to climate political leadership. Chelsea and I discuss how existing gender inequalities are exacerbated by the impacts of climate change. Then later in the episode, we'll hear from the wonderful Ugandan climate justice activist, Vanessa Nakate, about some of the impacts on the ground. How lucky I am to call both of these women friends. Lovely to connect with you again, Chelsea. Is your glass half empty or half full today?
Well, I'm getting over strep throat, so I'm glad that you can hear me because I still sound a bit scratchy to myself. But other than that, we're good. We're good, thankfully.
You can just pretend you've been like partying.
I have to say, like a few days ago, I really thought it sounds as if I've smoked like 2 to 3 packs a day for 20 years. Or that I'm really trying to channel like the 1930s, like glamorous movie stars who always sounded quite husky to me, although maybe that's also because they were probably heavy smokers.
I think, yeah, you shouldn't tell anyone you had strep throat and just go with the latter interpretation. I've been listening to your podcast today, so I've been listening to you, which has been nice. Well done on it.
Oh, thank you.
Really interesting conversations. So, first of all, I know you've been looking at this space quite a lot, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on the intersections between climate change and gender equality globally.
Oh, well, goodness, Lily. We know there are so many quite painful intersections between climate change and gender equality or gender inequality. And we know that, for example, with the rise of extreme weather events both becoming more frequent and more extreme, those events and the compression and cadence of those events are far more likely to push women into poverty all over the world, whether we're talking about here in the United States or throughout Latin America, throughout the Asia Pacific region, throughout Africa. We know that then consequently, kind of the effects of climate change, the ravages of climate change are far more likely to push women and children into homelessness and into food insecurity. We know that the effects of climate change are directly leading to an increase in child marriage around the globe, which overwhelmingly affects young girls. We know that the continued avoidance of climate change mitigation strategies and the continued absence of real urgency to move to more renewable sources of energy also continues to have disproportionately negative impacts on women and children. So we see that with extractive industries all over the world where women and children are more likely to be displaced and also often more likely to suffer the health consequences from the extractive industry. So, even just thinking about hydraulic fracking here in the United States, we now have overwhelming data that really proves that hydraulic fracking has quite devastating impacts on pregnant women and their children.
A study by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health states that expectant mothers who live near active natural gas wells operated by the fracking industry are at a higher risk of a premature birth. They cite that the cause could be air quality from the pollutants or potentially stress.
So, Lily, it's just a catalogue of ways in which climate change, the effects of climate change, the failures to deal with climate change, are borne most heavily by those who are already relatively more vulnerable, including and especially women and children.
And you've been working, as I understand it, for many, many years on public health and looking at development around the world. At what point did it come on your radar, the kind of intersection of many of these different social issues that you've looked at and we're talking about with climate change?
Oh, Lily, that's a really good question. I think that probably for me, both kind of, personally and then as a academic, as an activist, just as a citizen, so I guess those are a lot more identities than are implied by both. I think I first became, aware of how consequential climate change really is for public health, probably around Hurricane Katrina here in the United States, and the ways in which the natural disaster preyed on the unnatural or purposeful over many generations of structural inequality in the United States, and that Hurricane Katrina, while devastating for huge swaths of the Gulf Coast, were far more devastating for low-income families, for families who could not afford to get out of the path of the hurricane and could not afford to kind of build back immediately subsequent to the hurricane, and who were far more likely then to not only lose their homes, lose their livelihoods, in some cases to lose their lives, but also to suffer from ongoing housing insecurity, food insecurity, and with long tail health consequences. And, we have seen this pattern of natural disasters, preying upon pre-existing vulnerabilities that are often the consequence of generations of policy decisions that have been made in not only hurricanes, but also in heat waves, in droughts, and in many other weather events that, again, are becoming more extreme and more frequent because of climate change.
Hurricane Katrina, you may remember, was a large and destructive hurricane that hit New Orleans in the USA and caused over 1,800 fatalities in late August 2005. And 80% of those left behind were women.
And then, thinking about the ways in which rising temperatures, rising average temperatures around the world are affecting people's lives, people's individual and community health, and then ultimately our shared global public health. So whether that is kind of rising rates of respiratory illnesses, malaria becoming more common in places that believed it had eradicated malaria decades prior, whether it's again with droughts leading to more crop failures, leading to more food insecurity, whether it's the forced migration that has come from climate change, again, whether from extreme weather events or inhospitable, unendurable temperatures, and often then the devastating consequences for crops and livestock and the ways in which communities have lived for decades, centuries, and sometimes even millennia. And so, I think that my awareness of how painfully interlinked climate change and public health are probably originated in Hurricane Katrina here in the United States now, close to two decades ago. But then quickly, it was something that I began to see everywhere, sort of like when my children learn a new word, and then all of a sudden, it's a word that they seem to see in every book, on every passing street sign, and are trying to kind of, you know, wedge into their vocabulary every minute of every day. And I think that's kind of what happened after I began to recognize how interconnected, now it seems, of course, so obvious, climate change and public health really are.
Do you think that, have you looked at any of the reports that have connected the rise in zoonotic diseases like COVID to very similar causes of the climate and biodiversity crisis? And is that a conversation you've been aware of or part of? Because that also quite clearly links health with the environmental situation.
We're not short on evidence. We're just, at least here in the United States, short on, unfortunately, you know, politicians who are willing to listen to that evidence, you know, or slash and feel a responsibility to act on that evidence. And while that is certainly largely here, something that cleaves along party lines, it doesn't always cleave along party lines. Again, you know, just thinking about the debate around fracking here in the United States, that I don't think should be a debate, given the rather overwhelming preponderance of evidence that now proves how dangerous fracking is for mothers, especially expectant mothers, and children. And yet, for all of the kind of righteous rhetoric on the right in this country around being pro-life, there seems to be no connection of anything that isn't related to the act of giving birth to actually being pro-life, whether we're thinking about kind of the social safety net or investing in public education, investing in our care economy, or investing in mitigating climate change to help protect children, especially in this case. But also even among the Democrats, we don't have the consensus that I think we should have, that fracking is dangerous and we need to be making decisive steps away from it. So I think that we're not short on evidence linking climate change to a myriad of health outcomes, a myriad of disproportionate health outcomes, a myriad, arguably a calamity, of ways in which climate change worsens health inequities, whether we're talking about health inequities as relates to race, socioeconomic status, or gender. And yet, at least here in the United States, none of that has been sufficient to galvanize consensus of the need to take urgent, decisive action toward stopping climate change and toward protecting public health as a reason to take those climate change mitigation actions and to do it as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. I was hope is maybe a strange word to use, but I was hopeful that a silver lining to the crisis with COVID over the last year would be the kind of waking up to these intersections, to the fact that taking action on biodiversity and climate is not about protecting other species or, you know, caring about furry animals, et cetera, et cetera. It's actually about our own health also, and, you know, the fundamental need for a healthy environment. And it seemed unfortunate to me that those connections have been made, but they don't feel to be like the dominant mainstream understanding of the situation. In terms of the COP26, it was incredibly shocking to me at first that there were no women on the leadership team for the UK.
Well, and Lily, I think that's an important point. Like, they didn't even care enough to have a token.
Yeah, I know. It was just shocking. I was looking at the statistics from the COP in 2019, and women were also really, really heavily underrepresented internationally in different delegations. So there does seem to be an issue of not just women, also we could look at ethnicities too, but underrepresentation of the communities that might be hardest hit by climate change, let alone the need for diversity of thought in these negotiations. And yeah, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on that and how you feel like the US administration is performing at this time in terms of diversity and representation.
So I think those are two different and yet really important questions. So, you know, we have, again, overwhelming evidence that when women are included in decision-making, in negotiations and often the preceding step of agenda setting toward then negotiations, that what is on the agenda as well as what is discussed or debated and then what decisions are taken, whether kind of we're thinking about climate change negotiations, we have just huge amounts of evidence in this area, Lily, of why it matters when women are not just invited in, but actually included, listened to, are able to and do participate. We see this in data from everything from peace negotiations to trade negotiations in a multilateral sense to parliaments or legislatures at national and subnational regions are far more likely to allocate funds and give prioritization to issues that relate to health and education than parliaments and legislatures that don't include women. So truly, again, we have tremendous evidence that it matters when women are included and that it's not only good for women, it's good for everyone. Because of course, you know, when we are talking about what are conventionally quote unquote women's issues, like can women work outside the home? Are there sufficient childcare support mechanisms or tax credits? Are women and children being protected as and accounted for in peace negotiations? You know, that those kind of pathways and ultimately then those decisions are really good for everyone, including men. I will say, thankfully, about the Biden administration, it's not only at the cabinet level where we see women included and where we have the most inclusive cabinet of any presidential administration ever in American history, and where we see women in quite consequential roles. Specifically, when we think about climate change, while you know Secretary John Kerry is the official envoy for climate change, you know, so many of the people who are in his top coterie of advisors are women. And we also see, again, even in places where there may not be a woman at the top of the helm, like in, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services, and I think, you know, the secretary is eminently qualified, but so many of his top deputies are also women. And so I do think the Biden administration has taken real inclusion to mean, you know, we need real diverse representation actually at every level, you know, at the cabinet level, at the secretarial level, but also at the deputy level, and then at the various departments that often do the real labor of work, and also in the White House itself. So I am thankful that we have a president for whom it's not just tokenized or it doesn't feel like something that he's being pressed upon to do. And it feels deeply sincere. And it's not only kind of deeply sincere in what he's saying and how he's saying it, but very much in whom he's nominated, whom he's appointed, and equally importantly, whom he's empowered.
Yeah, I danced for joy when he won, as you can imagine. I'm sure you did too. And the fact that he appointed, the first female non-white vice president, was hugely encouraging. How do you feel? Because, I mean, you grew up in a political family. You've been working in the political space, or at least the social development space, for as long as I know you, which is a while, and longer before that. Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic in terms of the progression of gender equality globally?
Well, I'm an optimistic person, partly because, you know, I just have to believe, Lily, that our energies and efforts can make a difference. And, you know, I think about something that Jim Kim, the former president of the World Bank and one of the founders of Partners in Health, says, which is that optimism is a moral choice. And I do think it is a more moral decision to be optimistic. I also, though, am very concerned if we think about the ways in which COVID has disproportionately impacted women. The net job losses here in the United States have been borne entirely, almost, by women, and particularly, you know, Black and Brown women. And we also know that many women who say that they cannot envision still going back to work because you know, school is still not fully in session in many parts of the country. Daycares are not fully open in many parts of the country. The care economy, which was already deeply undervalued and not given sufficient dignity support or financial recognition, isn't close to back to fully functioning. And we also know that intimate partner violence has risen everywhere in the world during COVID. And so, you know, I am concerned that as we're thinking about moving forward out of this moment, that we're still not being, and I think the Biden administration, to give it credit, has been doing a good job, but still is not as focused as I would think we really need to be on ensuring that women are fully included in every aspect of planning for our continued recovery, and that women are fully included in the ongoing iteration of those plans and implementation going forward. Because I do think we will still be dealing with the ricochet effects of the pandemic for many months and years ahead. And so whether that's needing to think about how we support women's mental health, because we know that women, especially mothers, have had huge spikes in anxiety and depression and kind of other mental health challenges, or what we need to do to ensure women can come back into the workplace, all that we need to do across the globe, but particularly here to support the care economy, we have a lot of work to do.
I'm also going to share with you another conversation I had last year with the Ugandan climate justice activist, Vanessa Nakate. Vanessa is an incredible woman, and I've been watching her rise in the activist space over the last few years since I met her in Davos in 2020. Vanessa is the founder of the Rise Up movement, which gives African climate activists a platform for their voice to be heard. In 2020, she was named a UN Young Leader for the Sustainable Development Goals, and she's been listed as a top 100 women of the year by both the BBC and the Time 100 list. And she was recently nominated by Greta Thunberg for the Financial Times 25 Most Influential Women in 2021. In her book, The Bigger Picture, and in her activism, Vanessa tries to draw attention to climate justice, to the disproportionately high impacts of climate change being felt by some of the most marginalized communities and those that had the least responsibility for driving the climate crisis in the first place. Vanessa spoke to me about the challenges Africa and Uganda are facing and why gender equality and race are so intrinsic in these conversations.
So the climate crisis is something that affects every sector of the lives of the people in my country, in Africa, and across the world. And when it comes to my country or any other African country, it is more than just the floods. It is more than just the droughts. There are secondary impacts that happen after that. That is where all these intersections come in with other sustainable development goals. Because people will continuously be pushed in extreme poverty the more they experience climate disasters. So how shall we be able to eradicate poverty if climate change is happening and is destroying people's lives right now? How shall we be able to achieve zero hunger if millions of people are left with no food to eat? You know, so all these intersections, gender equality, in my country, especially in the rural communities, women are responsible for putting food on the table, for bringing water for their families. That means in case of a water crisis, they will have to walk long distances to get this water for their homes. They will have to face all challenges as they go to collect this water. They're exposed to gender-based violence. So there is a lot of intersection between climate change and other issues. Girls are at a risk of not being able to go back to school because they have to drop out and either help their families in recovering what has been lost. And last year, I read an article and it was talking about child brides. And this comes as a result of families losing everything to climate disasters and the parents deciding to give up some of their children for marriage so that they can get bride price, so that they can reduce on the number of kids that they're taking care of. And it is always the girl child who falls as a victim. She's the one who is given up for marriage. So that means climate change is affecting the lives of many girl children and leaving them with no future, exposing them to diseases, exposing them to early pregnancies, exposing them to early marriages. So there is so much over the intersection of climate change and other social issues. The climate crisis is affecting lives right now, is affecting our livelihoods and every sector of people's humanity, from food to water to education to gender equality, and also the wildlife itself. So there is so much about climate change that the world needs to understand. We cannot have peace building if there is climate change.
It's interesting that you spoke about how the climate crisis could negatively and is maybe negatively impacting on girls and women's rights, because conversely, there is a lot of kind of data and arguments that suggest that one of the keys to solving the climate crisis is empowering women. Have you been working in that space at all? And if so, what are your thoughts about the intersection between gender equality and the environment?
Yes, I strongly believe that there is an intersection between gender equality and the environment. And I also believe that women empowerment is a very strong solution to help us in fighting the climate crisis. When you look at Project Drawdown, it lists some of the activities that can help to cut down global emissions. And one of these activities is about educating girls and young women. And this is something that we don't often hear in environmental circles. This is a solution that I believe can work if it is carried out on a massive scale, educating girls and young women. Because when girls are educated, they make better decisions. And also, they choose to get married later on. And they have healthier children when they decide to have children. So this is something that is not talked about in environmental circles. And also one of those activities is family planning. I believe that if girls and women are educated about that and also given the tools or what is needed to carry out family planning, that is something that could help. If different women across the world are empowered to study through studying, through family planning, through education, then we believe that they will be able to have healthier lives and make better decisions for themselves and for their families.
I also remember in Project Drawdown that when women are given more land rights and more access to kind of agriculture work, they tend to, for some reason, increase agricultural output. And if you add together the two different aspects concerning women in Project Drawdown, so family planning and the education of women, it ends up being the number one solution that has the biggest impact.
I agree with you. And I believe that the girls and the young women that are educated today, they will be tomorrow's scientists, they will be tomorrow's politicians, and they will make the right decisions for the people and the planet. They will be tomorrow's activists, tomorrow's campaigners. So I believe that empowering women is one of the solutions that we need. And we know that that can even be started now. We hear so many technological solutions of addressing the climate crisis. But some of these solutions are under development, they're under research. It's a long process to have them implemented. Why don't we start with the solutions that we know will work? I believe that educating girls and women, empowering them, is a solution that environmental circles need to embrace.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask you about, what your thoughts are, if you have any thoughts around the intersections between race and the climate crisis. I'm thinking more from a historical lens of kind of colonialism and arguably now neocolonialism. But if you also want to talk about it in the kind of present moment or the way you see the future, feel free to answer it as you see fit.
I believe that the climate crisis is as a result of colonialism, imperialism, and this all started from the industrial revolutions and taking up lands of indigenous people, of marginalized communities for oil, for basically, I believe that was the start of what we are seeing right now. And this is something that has continued up to now. When you look at communities that are impacted the most, these are communities of indigenous people, marginalized communities, communities of Black people, communities of people of color. They are the ones facing the wrath of climate change. They are the ones in residences that are closed or that are suffering with massive air pollution, with residences that are next to incinerators, with residences that are next to coal power plants. These are all Black people and people of color. When you look at what is happening currently, the communities that are affected the most, they are in the Global South. They are the ones facing devastating impacts of climate change, from their homes being destroyed, from losing their people, from their farms, businesses being destroyed, to literally being left with nothing. Communities in the Global South are the ones being left in an economic crisis because of climate change. So there is an intersection. When you even look at the way the climate change is reported, less focus is usually put on the disasters in the Global South.
In 2019, two devastating cyclones swept through Mozambique, millions left needing humanitarian support. In 2021, a major drought saw a complete disappearance of food sources in Madagascar. The United Nations World Food Programme reported that it left people to eat only locusts and cactus leaves.
I believe that if there is coverage of these disasters, that creates the urgency, that creates the pressure on the leaders to actually take the action. Activists from the Global South, they have struggled so much to amplify their voices, to get their stories heard because of the kind of system that we found ourselves in. This system is one that chooses whose voice matters and whose voice doesn't matter, who gets to suffer and who doesn't get to suffer. We have to dismantle the system if we want to see just climate action. And I believe that there is no climate justice without racial justice. If we want to see the kind of justice that we need, that means we have to start from those communities impacted the most, telling their stories and providing solutions to the challenges that they are facing. These communities have felt the urgency. They have seen the disaster, and we need them included. We need their voices included if we want to get climate justice.
Vanessa received global attention in early 2020 when she attended Davos for the World Economic Forum and was cut out of a picture with four other white activists, famously tweeting, "They didn't erase a person, they erased a continent." Her attendance at the World Economic Forum in 2022 in Davos was very different, and she was invited into several panels inside the WEF to speak. I'll share with you now some of the things that she said in those panels, drawing attention to the very real impacts of climate change being felt by the Global South already today.
Let's talk about what the climate crisis has done at the expense of the investments of Europe. Historically, the African continent is responsible for less than 4% of global emissions, and we are seeing some of the worst impacts of the climate crisis. You've said we talk about the reality. Let me talk about the reality. The African continent is suffering some of the worst impacts of climate change. We have seen cyclones, from Cyclone Idai in 2019 that left more than 1,300 people dead, and many more were recorded as missing. We've seen the Eastern Africa drought that has left more than 26 million people with no access to food.
Since war has broken out in the Ukraine, there has been a growing awareness of the connections between energy, climate change, conflict and also food security. But what impact is this going to have for policymakers in terms of the energy revolution we need to see?
I know that Europe is considering looking for gas in African countries, so that is not enough. And it's only because of the interests of Europe and the national security concerns of Europe. But can we, for a moment, discuss the national security concerns of the Global South? We have opportunities to invest in clean energy. Why aren't we taking that direction? Why are we still thinking about opening up new coal power plants or gas or oil, yet it's only harming communities that are least responsible for this? You may bring the investments in Africa. You are the ones benefiting. We are the ones who suffer the impacts.
Both these conversations with Chelsea and Vanessa draw attention to the justice issues at the heart of the climate crisis. As Greta Thunberg wrote, captioning Vanessa's book, A Bigger Picture, Vanessa reminds us that while we may all be in the same storm, we are not all in the same boat. Coming up in this season, I speak with consumer activist, funny man, Joe Lycett, on queerness with Homo Sapiens podcast extraordinaire, Chris Sweeney, with the microbiology scientist from Chile, Christina Dorador, who's helping write Chile's new constitution, and with one of Afghanistan's first ever and youngest female mayors, Zarifa Ghaffari, and many other incredible voices.
Thank you so much for listening to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. We are so grateful for the guidance and resources from She Changes Climate on this series, an organisation enabling women in all their diversity to lead just climate action globally. And for the music that's been provided by the very wonderful musician, Cosmo Sheldrake. If you like this episode and would like other people to hear it, we'd be so grateful if you would rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts from. And to hear reasons to be optimistic, we have another little Who Cares Wins drop this Friday. This is a Mags Creative production. Catch you next time. Bye. Go down, let's go down. Let's go down. Don't you wanna come down? Count to 20.